Please don't ask me any questions about the Aurora project, Rich announced in his introduction. Aurora is reportedly the top-secret unmanned hypersonic reconnaissance craft that replaced the SR-71. I can't answer any, and if I did, I'd be thrown in jail. There are some representatives of the CIA here who I recognize. Rich continued for an hour reviewing the history of the Skunk Works, highlighted by numerous slides. He described the U-2 reconnaissance plane and its successor, the TR-1 variants, and the SR-71 Blackbird, and the little-known D-21 supersonic spy drone that was carried atop an SR-71 mothership, Tom continues. The part of the lecture in which he truly beamed was the F-117 stealth attack plane, sometimes erroneously called a stealth fighter. All of these aircraft were built by the Skunk Works, not designed by them and then built by someone else. 10. Clarence Kelly Johnson was the legendary designer of aircraft such as the above. Of related interest, the Lockheed A-12 reconnaissance aircraft, codenamed Oxcart, of which 13 were built at the Skunk Works for the CIA, preceded both the YF-12 interceptor and the SR-71, ordered by the U.S. Air Force. Donald Phillips, who prior to joining the U.S. Air Force worked as a design engineer on the SR-71 project with Johnson, stated cautiously at a National Press Club conference in 2001 that he was aware of evidence that these aircraft had served in another capacity apart from their more routine missions. Each pilot, and I knew a few of them, learned about the assignment immediately prior to takeoff, and there's strong evidence to suggest that there was a dual role in that they were monitoring some type of traffic to and from Earth. 11. At one point in his memorable presentation, Ben Rich said, "If you can imagine it, Lockheed Skunk Works has done it," a phrase he later repeated on two occasions. And in his concluding comments, he added, "We already have the means to travel among the stars. But these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. Anything you can imagine, we already know how to do." He then showed his last slide, an artist's conception of a flying disc zipping off into the unknown, and announced, "We now have the technology to take E.T. home." The reaction of the audience was nervous laughter, Tom recalls. "My interpretation was that this was Rich's way of saying, we can do it now." A few others in the room, including my friend Jan, also took this statement very seriously. All you had to do was read between the lines. The talk concluded with some questions and answers, and the formal part of the program was over. As soon as it ended, about 30 of us crowded around Rich like rock fans around the Beatles at their last concert. I was beginning to wonder if anyone else, except Jan, as he and I think alike, in the audience was having the same thoughts. Could Skunk Works be working on some otherworldly craft as we spoke? One man spoke up and said that he was a new manager at Northrop, which built the B-2A Spirit stealth bomber, and wanted Rich's advice. Rich pointed his finger at the man and said, "Well, let me ask you a question, is it possible to travel to the stars?" The man was taken aback a bit and then said, "Oh, sure. It would just take a long time." Rich replied, "No, it won't take someone's lifetime to do it. There is an error in the equations, and we know what it is, and we now have the capability to travel to the stars." Rich went on to imply that various people at Skunk Works had been studying alternative propulsion technologies for interstellar travel, and said they had, for example, determined that Einstein's equations dealing with relativity theory were incorrect. I asked him to clarify that. Did he mean that Skunk Works employed theoretical physicists, Einstein types, to look for alternative means of space travel? Rich said yes, then went on to say that they had proved that Einstein was wrong. He made a mistake. I didn't know how that set with other people in the room, but to me that possibly meant that they had determined how it was possible to travel faster than the speed of light. It's important to keep in mind that Skunk Works is a fabrication outfit. They are not in business to be a theoretical think tank. My take on this was that at Skunk Works they were looking for loopholes in Einstein's work that would give them a way of traveling at ultra-high, faster-than-light speeds, to the stars and back. I interpreted Rich's comments to mean that the scientists at Skunkworks had found such a loophole, and they were building or had built a craft to do it. One woman in the small crowd apparently had similar thoughts. She asked, "Mr. Rich, when will the ETs go home?" Rich smiled, looked down at the floor, and said nothing. Some of us were left wondering what his response might have been had he been able to answer without fear of being sentenced to 20 years in Fort Leavenworth. As Rich was walking out of the door, Jan followed him and asked privately, "Ben, what equations are you talking about?" He just looked at Jan, who then explained that he was interested in propulsion and wanted to know how UFO propulsion worked. Rich said, "Let me ask you, how does ESP work?" Jan replied without thinking, "All points in time and space are connected?" Rich shot back, "That's how it works." Jan did not know if Rich was referring to his question or his answer. Rich then turned around and abruptly left the room. 12. The great pioneer died of cancer in January 1995, aged 69. Chapter 10, Grey Liaison. The summer of 2009 brought me a promising letter. I have a true story to tell, which relates to my RAF service, 1955 to 1957, and involves an alien situation at the camp where I was stationed, the writer began. I need some advice and wonder if you have time for a chat? I would add that my involvement, with five of my RAF, Fleet Air Arm pals, fills the gap relating to Britain. 1. My informant, Thomas, spoke guardedly about the gist of the alien situation when I first conversed with him on the phone, stressing that he was still bound by the Official Secrets Act. However, he wished to include the story in a book he was currently engaged in writing about his Royal Air Force career and requested my guidance on how to proceed. I agreed to visit him for a couple of days at his home in the West Country. Much of the information presented in this chapter is taken from Thomas's remarkable manuscript Comma 2 and from my regular communications with him. Thomas began by giving me details of his national service record. In March 1955, at the age of 18, he had been posted to RAF Cardington, Bedfordshire. He then was posted as Airman 2nd Class, IC2, to Paget, Lancashire, for square bashing, consisting largely of .303 rifle, bayonet drill. Following that came trade training, in which Thomas and his colleagues were given a choice of 5 RAF trades. Thomas ticked off 5 admin jobs, and was assigned to the Equipment Provisioning and Accounting Section, EPAS, at RAF Credon Hill in Hereford for 5 weeks training. In due course, he was posted to RAF Western's Oiland, Somerset, and nearby RAF Merrifield. Located some 4 miles from Bridgwater, Western's Oiland was originally a World War II airfield, opened in 1944 and used jointly by the Royal Air Force and United States Army Air Forces, primarily for transport aircraft. It was also used, I learned, as a secret base in that period by Britain's Special Operations Executive. So, after the end of war in the European theatre, 4 fighter squadrons occupied the station briefly. The station was then used as a reserve RAF Fighter Command airfield, but little flying took place there until the summer of 1952, when Meteor and Vampire jets operated there in a training role. Canberra bomber, photo reconnaissance and training aircraft were present during the mid-1950s. By 1958, no more aircraft used Western's Oiland. During the relevant period, the commanding officer was Group Captain H. E. Hopkins. Today, several derelict buildings remain, excluding the hangars but including the control tower, which I explored in September 2010. Part of the airfield is used nowadays for microlights, and it is also a base for the Skywatch Civil Air Patrol. At the time of Thomas's posting there, Western's Oiland had been taken over by the Fleet Air Arm, FAR. EPAS included a squadron leader in charge, plus a flight lieutenant, a couple of corporals, and the 6 airmen, including Thomas, who became firm friends with his colleagues. One morning, the flight sergeant, Flight, came over to the EPAS office and whispered to Thomas that he was to present himself in the squadron leader's office at 10 o'clock, to say nothing to anyone, and to join his colleagues. The flight sergeant ordered the men to be on parade outside number one hangar at 8:30 the following morning, dressed in their best blues. At the appointed hour, the IPA's team assembled outside the hangar, followed by the squadron leader with three others, one in naval uniform. The team snapped to attention. "Airmen," began the squadron leader, "you will all recall signing the Official Secrets Act. You will be here until the end of your service, by which time the matter you will be dealing with will have been resolved. Or should be. Your duties will be extraordinary, to say the least. No badges of any sort were to be worn. To anyone in camp you will be rankless and anonymous," continued the squadron leader. "On the left upper left of both your new working blues you will find an orange band already in place. You will not remove them at any time. You will have no status whatsoever as far as any other personnel can see. Only yourselves and others involved on the project will know who you are, and from time to time that will include civilians as well as members of the armed forces. You will all receive a small pay increase and will deserve it. However, you will say nothing about it to anyone, even at home, if you go on leave. The increase will be on a scale higher than your actual rank. Simply follow orders quietly and responsibly and all will go well and smoothly. You cannot go off camp in uniform, nor take your orange flashes off camp, nor will you say one single word about today for the remainder of your service, not even to your nearest and dearest. Is that perfectly understood?" The team confirmed that it was. "Now, of course, you are all curious as to what the hell this is all about. You will return to your billet, then change into your new shirt sleeve order, with orange flashes worn as instructed. Be here at number one hangar at 14:30 hours for a further briefing. Stay together and not a word to anyone, no matter who." Code Orange. Thoroughly bemused, Thomas and his colleagues, now effectively attached to the Fleet Air Arm, presented themselves outside hangar number one at the appointed time. The squadron leader summoned the men into the hangar and ordered them to sit down on a row of six chairs, individually assigned with the men's initials. Opposite stood a table with four chairs. A car drew up outside and the three men from earlier that day came and sat down, dressed this time in civilian suits. One was tall and hawkish, Thomas reported, and the other strongly built with a head of white hair. The naval officer sat away from them, allowing our squadron leader to sit beside him, but between him and the two civilians. "You are now attired as you will be for the remainder of your service," began the squadron leader. "You each have certain things in common. For example, you passed your RAF entrance exams at the top of your classes, though of course you did not know that about each other. Equally, at your respective training camps you were recorded as best airman in your flight. I shall not introduce you to the three gentlemen with me today. If any of you feel you know any or all of them by sight, forget it and say nothing. The task you are going to undertake may be quite easy, but it could become extremely difficult. We have known about it for some years and have made certain preparations at this airfield during the past 6 months. You may have observed activity at and near this hangar which appeared to be a building project. It is a secret project and all works have been carried out by military experts, some flown in from the United States and Canada. The men and women involved are no longer in camp. The project henceforth was to be referred to as Code Orange. All personnel in camp have been told the airmen with orange flashes are on sensitive RAF work," continued the squadron leader. "And you are not to be interrupted, questioned as to your work or whatever. If you are questioned, then treat it as a breach of security, reporting the incident on the phone in your new quarters." Thomas and another colleague, Alan, were assigned overall charge of Code Orange, within the camp perimeter. Next, one of the suits, the man with white hair, addressed the new team, after thanking the squadron leader for his briefing. "I work for the government as a scientist and feel satisfied that all has gone as it should here today," he began. "So, what is Code Orange about?" "It is about an incident that occurred in the American state of New Mexico during 1947, a most unfortunate incident that involved living beings from another world crashing to Earth, for reasons I will not go into here, and of deaths and casualties," claimed the man. code oranges about ordinary country people on the spot at the time and of military personnel becoming involved and/or orders from their superiors within the military and within the government. Code orange is about putting right, as best we can, a mess. I am here to explain your part, and perhaps then we can learn more about how to take advantage of the alien technology as a priority over alien life. Whatever the outcome, Code Orange is about a strange craft and its occupants who did not complete their journey in New Mexico after all. Well, two of them did not, and who knows if others got away. There were three craft on the 1947 situation, each with seating areas for three. Two dead bodies were recovered, two alive and still held by the military. Other craft have been sighted over many years and many have landed. They are not all from the same place, and are therefore of different races. The two aliens still held by the military are having, shall we say, an English holiday. It is too hot for them where they were and the wrong people are getting close. The aliens are vastly more intelligent than we are as a race. So despite considerable arguments, they themselves have forced a move, and months of talks and time wasting have at last resulted in Code Orange. The two aliens went silent, refusing to communicate unless they were moved. They do not speak and voice their words aloud as we do, but they converse with each other and us in silence. For want of a better expression, the term thought transference will do, but they communicate mood too. Your task is to look after them here, until they decide to communicate again, or not. You will be shown how. That was it, really, reflected Thomas. The other two did not have anything to say to us. I remember sitting quietly, trying to take it all in. Then we were told to sort out our new billet at the side of number one hangar and settle in immediately. Sunrise and sunset, the office at Weston's Oiland was reached by the team directly from their billet, and another door led into the hangar. A long desk with three chairs was along one wall, with two telephones, piles of notepads, pens, pencils, and a radio set and typewriter, Thomas reported. Filing cabinets were ready for use and a screen looked into the hangar, but was not on at first. Fire buckets and extinguishers, tea and coffee facilities and water were laid onto a sink basin. A fairly ordinary situation then, but extraordinary was a metal cupboard with revolvers and ammunition and a set of white overalls for all of us. Thomas's team had the use of other amenities nearby and were permitted access to the NAFI, Navy, Army and Air Force Institutes, shop and the mess at mealtimes, though only two at a time. The team received orders to man the office from 8 o'clock to 1600 hours each day, until further notice. At that time we organized 2 4-hour shifts, always with Alan or myself leading these in turn, Thomas explained. We received phone calls on a regular basis to verify that all was well, from an anonymous female voice, the origin of which we were never told. We were given a password, Sunrise, and had to use it in reply to the woman's password, Sunset, which I will never forget. Special delivery, the team looked after the office and kept themselves fit by running or walking outside the hangar and in the large field adjoining it. Nothing relevant occurred until well into the second week, when a phone call came from a man advising Thomas that a Code Orange delivery was due on the Saturday of the following week. Early on the next Monday morning, the team was advised that their password would change to that of the project name. The usual female contact advised them that on Wednesday at 8 o'clock a special consignment would be arriving, at Merrifield. Thomas told me that the special consignment, originating in the US, was delivered from somewhere in the UK. Scotland, he believes, by train, ending its rail journey at Ilton Holt, thence by a huge vehicle to Merrifield. Like Weston's Oiland, Merrifield had been used in World War II by the USAF and RAF, and then by the latter as an advanced pilot and training establishment with Meteor and Vampire jets until the end of 1954. During the following 2 years, which involved Code Orange, a detachment from an operational conversion unit, with Canberra jets, was often present. Then came the Royal Navy with Sea Venoms, until 1958. By 1961, it was abandoned until 1971 when, As Royal Naval Air Station Merrifield, HMS Heron II, it was used for assault helicopter training and exercises. Today, it remains an operational airfield and a restricted area, with security on the gate. 3, about 20 feet high and 8 to 10 feet deep. The wooden crate was hauled onto the back of a large wide-load vehicle, secured with steel cable hawsers on its narrow end. It didn't cause a lot of problems along those Somerset roads on its short journey to Merrifield, as one might imagine, Thomas explained to me. However, some traffic problems delayed delivery. It was 11 o'clock when the two motorcycle MPs, military police, roared up to the doors of number one hangar, followed by the huge wide load vehicle, all noise and flashing lights, then two more motorcycles with a staff car following, Thomas reports. The hangar door slid smoothly shut on it. An hour or so later, the presence of a group captain in the hangar was announced to the team via phone. On being admitted to the office, he introduced himself, explaining first that a viewing screen in the office was now operational, enabling the men to see into the hangar. The hangar had a pitch roof with rows of skylights and a pair of very large hangar sliding doors to the front, Thomas continues. There were rows of strip lighting for night use. Our billet cum office was on one side abutting the west hall of the hangar with the one door between us. An orange 6-inch diameter circle was painted on it, and the viewing screen had a small red light above it, no doubt showing it was on. From within the hangar there was no way of knowing what was behind our door. A large red brick room had been built at the back of the hangar, within which was another room mainly made of glass or similar material. Its rear wall, really a gigantic window, looked out across the Somerset countryside to a distant perimeter fence we were told was electrified, Thomas revealed. We later learned that the electrified fence was only fixed about number one hangar at Merrifield and that the fencing around the remainder of the camp remained normal. Just beyond this fence was another, some 8 feet high but not electrified, and beyond it were fields and a river. Due to the slope from the rear of the hangar down to the river, the view was not despoiled by the fencing, nor could anyone else see in. About 50 feet by 40, the glass room was divided in two by a dark glass partition. Normal daylight was adequate, but strip lighting was used at night. Other rooms in the hangar were color-coded differently, each with windows looking into the hangar. Security was very tight. We could see two men on a high platform facing the hangar doors. During a practice security drill, we had seen a row of vertical bars shoot up from the ground, and at that instant two armored vehicles appeared. When the crate had been positioned in the hangar and the lid taken away, the day after its arrival, the team was allowed to inspect it. Almost touching the sides was a gray, glistening metallic saucer of perfectly circular shape, Thomas describes. It had what looked like a window all the way around but with no panes, just one strip of glass-like material, and we could see within two panels of instruments, screens, and three seats. At a nod from the group captain, four men in overalls ran across and within minutes the sides of the crate were on the floor. It looked, said Thomas, like two saucers, one in the usual position with the other upside down on top of it. Strange though it may seem, I felt it was alive and thinking, silent but as if brooding. It was more alive than any other inanimate object I had ever seen. Three small seats with seemingly molded curved topped backs, evidently not designed for adults of normal human stature, could be seen. No seat belts or any obvious driving apparatus were noted. As Thomas reveals, the panel of instruments facing the seats swept around the front half of the craft and was black or very dark gray. There were scores of keys of the shape and size of our modern computers, plus several screens of about 1 foot by 6 inches, 30-15 centimeters, some vertical, some horizontal. Along the lower length of the panel was a desk with more keys in neat rows and at each end a pale grey-colored list in some printed form of hieroglyphics. Above the main panel was a larger screen, again dark, and of about 3 feet by 2 feet and fitted as a horizontal, like a modern TV screen. The area behind the seats was relatively bare, with the exception of half a dozen circular switches, almost flush to the wall. asked if the team could enter the craft, the group captain began by expounding on the actual event that had led to its recovery. The one in the hangar had followed two others down, one badly damaged with bits strewn over the desert, the other badly damaged but intact, he explained. This one came down of its own volition, that is, it was not shot at. At that time it was on a set of tripod-type legs, with a small disc at the end of each. The group captain went on to explain that the craft had been opened by its occupants at the crash site in New Mexico. Two aliens were seen to emerge, but a third remained inside, then simply stood up and disappeared and hadn't been seen since, despite the area having been searched for a week. The other two aliens were seemingly unwell, said the group captain. They were easily apprehended and had no weapons. If all three craft had three occupants, we have dead and alive evidence of six. It is known that one, apparently unhurt, left this craft and has since escaped detection somehow. The other two may have been thrown out from the two crashes and lost, or they also escaped. On the third occupant's disappearance, the exit-cum-entrance facility was seen to close itself. It has not opened or been opened since. We just can't bloody well open the thing. The seal is absolute perfection. The metal and glass are absolutely unknown to us. The other two damaged craft were kept in great secrecy at a certain US base, the group captain revealed. All I know, he said, is that parts of its amazing system of navigation, and some sort of tiny technological brains, which have to do with communication and pretty well everything else, are hastily being examined by various world scientists to see how we humans can benefit by them. Later that day, the group captain explained to the team that visits to the craft at Merrifield were permitted, provided they were dressed in their white overalls unique to the team, and that authorization had been obtained by their Code Orange contact. At Weston's Oiland, where the aliens were to be housed, the team agreed to 8-hour shifts with three men on and three off, with one of each three always by the phone. So it was 0800 to 1600, 1600 to midnight, and midnight to 0800, explained Thomas. However, two officers and a scientist came on duty during the early shift's lunch break, allowing the team a two-hour respite. Not of this earth, some days later. And RAF V bomber, either a Valiant, Victor, or Vulcan, capable of delivering nuclear weapons but in this operation delivering two aliens, landed at Weston's Oiland with a two fighter jet escort. Thomas told me he was fairly certain that the bomber was a Vulcan. The team was told to remain in their office and await further orders. A few hours later, they were summoned, two by two, to meet the alleged aliens, now ensconced in a specially constructed glass container in the hangar at Weston's Oiland. Thomas and his colleague Alan were first. Emotions welled up in me that I feel to this day, Thomas admitted. Two thin little people lay side by side. They were gray-colored and their heads seemed rather large for their bodies and were oval, or egg-shaped, with the large end at the top, a large cranium leading down to a small chin, and their eyes were large, limpid, and dark with no iris visible. Just dark, lustrous pools, wide open, rather like those of seals, I thought. There were nostril holes but no nose projecting from the face, and I could see a small mouth beneath. There were no visible projecting ears as we have. Sinewy arms stretched alongside their bodies and the legs looked skinny. They were very still. Unreal, I thought. I looked at their hands. Four long fingers similar to us, but no thumbs, and four toed feet. Just beneath the small chin of the body nearest to me a pulse was beating, and looking at the other being I could see the same. I was actually looking at two people from somewhere else. Not of this earth, I glanced across at the officer and met his eyes. He smiled and nodded, as if to say yes, this is real, they are alive. Shaking, Thomas made for a chair and sat down, followed by Alan. They didn't feel it was appropriate to stare at the aliens too much. They look so dignified, said Alan. One appeared slightly shorter than the other. They seemed frail, though Thomas sensed a latent strength about them. Half an hour later, all of the team having seen the beings and returned to the office, the officer, instructor declared that he didn't know which sex the aliens were. He thought they wore a membranous covering, but added that the Americans hadn't been very forthcoming with their information. He suggested that the team gave names to the aliens if they wanted, but that officially they were referred to by their American captors as G-32 and G-33.